Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavitvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Kataksha kirana chanta naman mohabdhaye namaha. Anantananda Krishnaya Jagan Mangalamurtaye. Welcome back to our Vedanta class on Advaita Makaranda. We will pick up the thread. Before we continue here, just two comments about our prior class. We had a nice discussion about how an enlightened person who suffers from dementia, like Alzheimer's, doesn't lose their enlightenment. And one reason I failed to give is a very fundamental reason, and that is we said bondage is due to ignorance, and enlightenment is knowledge destroying that ignorance. In the absence of that ignorance, one is enlightened. That ignorance, of course, is what leads us to be identified with our body and minds. When we're identified with the body and mind, we suffer. When knowledge destroys the ignorance that causes identification with the body and mind, we no longer suffer. Body has its problems, mind has its problems, but when you're disidentified with the body and mind, there's no more suffering. Now, when ignorance is destroyed, it can't come back. That which is destroyed, when you burn a piece of paper, it doesn't come back. It can't come back. In the same way, when ignorance is destroyed, it can't come back. So it is for an enlightened person who suffers from dementia. Ignorance has already been destroyed. It can't come back. Therefore, there cannot be any further identification with the body and mind. Of course, for the demented person, the mind is in terrible shape, and that is present. That dementia is present in the enlightened person's experience, but there's no identification with it. Therefore, no suffering. Okay. And by the way, we'll come back to that point a little bit in this with this next verse. I saw a comment that I misspoke towards the end of the prior class. At one point, I was talking about knowledge, and I said jnanam, knowledge, covers the true self and prevents you from discovering your true nature. Obviously, I meant ajnanam, ignorance covers your true self, prevents you from recognizing your true nature. The mind gets tired and words come out wrong. And fortunately, you're all astute enough to catch me when I go off, and that's really good. Okay, let us proceed to the next verse. Tatapya bhati kopyesha, tatapya bhati. Tatapya bhati kopyesha vichara bhava jivanaha, vichara bhava jivanaha, avashyaya chirakashe, avashyaya chirakashe, vicharko dayavadihi. Vicharar go dayavadihi. Good. Vasanti, you can. Okay. This verse is, remember we said most verses, almost all of these verses, are actually responses to objections or doubts one might have. The whole text is to remove these doubts. So what doubt is being addressed by this particular verse? We were just talking about dementia in an enlightened person. Well, how about even before enlightenment, the mind is full of ignorance. So the question is, does the ignorance in your mind, does the ignorance in an unenlightened mind, or does the dementia in an enlightened mind, does it affect consciousness? Does it affect chit is a word used here in this verse. And we're going to, let's stay focused, we'll set the dementia aside, I think, and stay focused on this ignorance. Does ignorance affect consciousness? And that's what's being addressed here. And he says, tata api, even though ko kaha api eshaha, at the end of the first line, kaha api eshaha is a Sanskrit idiom that means something or another. And the commentator says something or another we're talking about is ignorance. It's some kind of ignorance-based thought, like in a prior verse where we saw the person who says, na prakashe, I am not conscious. We saw that in the prior verse, which led to our discussion about dementia. I am not conscious, an ignorance-based thought. So that is referred to here as kaha api eshaha. Whatever it is in your mind, based on ignorance, which abhati, which appears, so tatapi, even when some ignorance or something based on ignorance, abhati, appears in your mind. And how does it appear in your mind? It is vichara abhava jivanaha. Jivanaha, literally, it is given life, but better translation, it is caused by jivanaha. It is caused by the abhava, the absence of vichara. Vichara, inquiry. Inquiry is what we're doing right now. We call it atma, vichara. Self-inquiry is the main practice in Advaita Vedanta that leads you to discover your true nature. So vichara abhava jivanaha, due to the absence of self-inquiry guided by the teachings of Vedanta, kopi eshaha, something appears in your mind, something based on ignorance. Even as we saw in a prior verse, the person who says, I am not conscious, as we said, you have to be conscious that you're to even make that statement. So based on ignorance. So now the question is, how does that ignorance affect consciousness? What is the relationship between that ignorance and consciousness? He gives a very beautiful metaphor here. He says that ignorance is avashyayaha chit-akashe. That ignorance is chit-akashe. This is an expression that's often used in the scriptures. In fact, I think we've seen it earlier in this text. Akasha means space. Chit-akasha, which then combines to form the word chit-akasha, the space of consciousness. And consciousness is not space, nor is space consciousness, but nor is space equal to consciousness. But this expression is used because the term chit-akasha suggests the vastness, the limitlessness, the all-pervasiveness of chit, of consciousness. So chit akashe, in the vast, all-pervasive consciousness, that ignorance, abhati, it appears. All kinds of nonsense appears in the space of consciousness. And he gives a metaphor, just like avashyayaha. Avashyayaha is fog or mist. So if you get up early in the morning, very often you can see the fog or mist, often near the ground. And that fog or mist, the question is how substantial is that fog or mist? And I want to, before we proceed, I want to go back to an observation we made before with regard to what is real. What is real is that which is trikala, abaditam, existed, past, present, future, unchanging, unborn, and eternal, doesn't come and go. What about mist? Comes and goes. So comparatively speaking, fog or mist is not very substantial, and that's used as a metaphor for ignorance, which is similarly not very substantial. It doesn't hang around, it goes. And he concludes the metaphor, vichara arka udaya avadihi. In fact, it's nice, it's called a mixed metaphor. So he says that the like mist persists until there is arka udaya. See, I'm skipping the first word in the last line. Arka, sun, udaya, rise, avadhi, is limit. And you translate that as until the sun rises. So how long does that mist persist in the early morning? Arka, udaya, avadihi. The mist persists until the sun comes up. As soon as the sun rises, the mist or fog is burnt away immediately. It's very unsubstantial. Not only is it unsubstantial, but the sun drives it away. We're going to come back to that point. So here, now we'll shift from the drishtanta, which is that fog or mist, to the darshtanta, that which is represented by the metaphor, which is ignorance. How long does ignorance last? Ignorance, like fog or mist, lasts until the sunrise. Ignorance lasts until vichara arka, the sun of vichara, inquiry. We saw that word in the second line. Here it comes again. So in the second line, it says ignorance is due to the absence of vichara. So here, in the presence of vichara, in the fourth line, the vichara arka, the self-inquiry guided by the teachings of Vedanta, which is like the sun, so the udaya avadihi, until that vichara arises like the sun. The mist persists until the sun rises, and the mist of ignorance, to mix the metaphor, the mist of ignorance persists until the sun of knowledge dawns in your mind. That's the intent of this metaphor. Now, there's something tricky here. When the sun of knowledge arises in your mind, notice that when ignorance is present, ignorance is present in a mind, in the presence of consciousness, the point here is consciousness doesn't make ignorance go away. Knowledge makes ignorance go away. Consciousness reveals whatever's in your mind. And ignorance happens to be one of the many things in your mind. The ignorance in your mind is removed by knowledge, jnana. And specifically, knowledge in the form of a vritti. Jnana vritti. Vritti means a thought form. A thought in the form of knowledge. Jnana vritti is the discovery, the recognition of your true nature. That jnana vritti is here called vichararka, the sun of the light of self-inquiry. It arises, it drives away the ignorance. And The important point here is, and this is going to make a transition into the next verse. Let me work on this a little bit. How real do I want to go there? And we'll skip that. How real is ignorance? We discussed before that which is absolutely real doesn't come and go. The fact that ignorance gets destroyed shows it is less real than chit, consciousness. Consciousness, your true nature, doesn't come and go, as we've discussed at great length. But ignorance comes to an end. Meaning, it's not absolutely real. Leading now to this next discussion, this will introduce the next verse. To remove, let's use the technical term, that which is absolutely real, we call satyam. That which is absolutely unreal, like the elephant in my hand, we can call asat, or the technical term adhyanta abhava, the absolute non-existence. But when we say ignorance is less real, we're not saying it's like the elephant in my hand. So it has an intermediate reality. We've had this discussion before. There's an absolute reality. There's absolute non-existence, which is the other extreme. And there's an intermediate reality, which is like the pot. The pot has an existence, which is temporary. There was a time before this pot existed. There will be a time when this pot no longer exists. It exists for a period of time in the middle. Further, this pot exists dependent on clay. For both of these reasons, we use a technical term to describe the reality of this pot. The word you know very well is mithya. This pot is mithya. Now, here's the point. To destroy a mithya pot, do you need a satya hammer? How's this? To destroy a mithya pot, you don't need a real hammer. You need a hammer that's as real as the pot. A mithya hammer is good enough to destroy a mithya pot. The point is that if you have a problem, the solution has to belong to the same order of reality. Here, the order of reality is mithya. My favorite example of this is if you're thirsty while you're dreaming, you have a lot of water in your house, but it doesn't do you any good at all in your dream. Waking water won't help you if you're thirsty in a dream. If you're thirsty in a dream, you need dream water. Now, look at this. Dream thirst is not real. To solve the problem of dream thirst, you don't need real water. You need dream water. Do you see where this discussion goes? Ignorance is not real. Ignorance is mithya. What? Watch this. To get rid of ignorance, which is not absolutely real, which is mithya, do you need real knowledge or mithya jnana? This apparent knowledge, knowledge which has the intermediate level of reality. You don't, just as I said, to destroy a mithya pot, you don't need a real hammer, you need a mithya hammer. To remove ignorance, you require what? You require knowledge that is as real as the ignorance. The ignorance is mithya. The knowledge you require is of the same order. Now, what do we mean by mithya knowledge? we're studying Vedanta, the teachings of Vedanta. Now we can, and this will lead us to the next verse. So we can challenge ourselves now by saying, is the knowledge imparted by Vedanta absolutely real as Brahman, as real as Satchitananda Atma? Do you see the problem? Vedantic teachings are in a form of words. Words are part of our everyday reality. Even the words of Vedanta are part of our everyday reality. Therefore, the words of Vedanta cannot have absolute reality. The words of Vedanta have this relative reality. Remember the terms we used: paramarthika satta, absolute reality; vyavaharika satta, empirical reality; and pratibhasika satta, projected reality. We had these words up on the board several classes ago. We won't go through that. But we identified these three layers of reality, three orders of reality. Paramarthika satta, absolute reality. Vyavaharika satta, empirical reality. Pratibhasika, projected reality, like in your dream. That's why for your dream thirst, which is pratibhasika, having that lowest level of reality, for your dream thirst, you require water of the same order of reality, pratibhasika, dream water for your dream thirst. Not real water, not water from the tap, water in your dream. Now look what this leads us to. For removing ignorance, ignorance which belongs to your mind which belongs to this vyavaharika satta, this empirical world, to remove the ignorance in your mind, which is at an empirical level, you require teachings at the same level, empirical level. And the teachings at an empirical level are the teachings of Vedanta. Now, that all sounds really good until the objection comes, the doubt comes. And the doubt, let me try to make it sound dramatic. Are you telling me that Vedanta is not real? Vedanta is not an absolute truth? Exactly. In fact, if Vedanta were more real than your ignorance, it couldn't remove the ignorance, just like real water, water from your tap, can't remove your dream thirst. In the same way, if Vedanta somehow were absolute reality, that absolute reality couldn't remove your ignorance. Now, this leads to something very surprising, because of what it suggests is that all of our scriptures, the scriptures, the basic scriptures, the Vedas, as you remember, have two parts, Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. Karmakanda, the portion with all the rituals, we don't have to get into all these details, but most of the Vedic teachings are instructions for performing rituals and the prayers and meditations that accompany those rituals. That section of the Veda is called Karma Kanda. Kanda, the section which is concerned with karma. Here, karma means Vedic rituals. When the word karma is used with regard to the Veda, it means rituals. And what is the purpose of all those rituals? Ultimately, those rituals are meant to help you go to Swarga, heaven. So the rituals reveal, the karma kanda of the Veda, and this, by the way, is to introduce the next verse. Don't think I'm just wandering here. This is we're going towards the next verse. The karma kanda of the Veda establishes the existence of Swarga, heaven, and the means to get to heaven through these rituals supported by prayers and meditation. So we have the Vedas in these two parts, the Karma Kanda of the Veda, whose subject matter is Swarga, going to heaven, and the rituals that get you to heaven, and then the portion of the Veda that we study, we call it Veda Anta, the Anta, the last part of the Vedas, which are the Upanishads, the basic scriptures on which all these teachings are based. We call this Jnana Kanda. The Kanda, the portion of the Vedas concerned with Jnana, knowledge, and that portion is concerned, the subject matter is moksha. So, in the Vedas, we have two parts with two different subject matters. The first part, Karma Kanda, the subject matter is Swarga, heaven. The second part, Jnana Kanda, the subject matter is moksha. And we just got done saying that these Vedas are not absolutely real. If the Vedas are not absolutely real, what they teach is not absolutely real, meaning, and this is the final part of the objection, that Swarga, heaven, and moksha, liberation, are not absolutely real. That's the objection. So if we say that the teachings of Vedanta belong to this Vyavaharika Satta, this empirical reality, they're not absolutely real, and they cannot produce an absolutely real result. Empirical teachings can only produce an empirical result, not an absolute result. So what does that mean for the validity of our scriptures? What does that mean for the verity, the existence of Swarga, heaven, and moksha, liberation? By the way, there's some occasionally students of Vedanta, I had this problem also, that there's a tendency to reject part of the Vedas. So we reject the Some people want to reject the portion of the Vedas that teaches Swarga, heaven, and to accept only the portion of the Veda that teaches moksha, liberation. The problem with that approach, and I made that mistake early on too, the problem with that approach is if you reject the authority of the Vedas to reveal Swarga, heaven, the Upanishads are part of that Veda. So if you reject Swarga, you simultaneously reject moksha. You can't pick one part and throw the other away. It's one scripture. The Veda is one scripture. So if you deny the authority of the Veda to reveal Swarga, heaven, you simultaneously deny the authority of the Veda to reveal anything about moksha liberation. These are the doubts which are dealt with in the next verse. Atma jnana maha nidra, atma jnana maha nidra, jrim bhitesmin jagan maye. Jaram bhitesmin jagan maye, dirgha swapne spurantyete, dirgha swapne spurantyete, swarga mokshadi vibramaha, swarga mokshadi vibramaha. You see my note, translation in reverse order. In order to get a meaning of this verse, we actually have to take each line, each quarter of the verse, in reverse order. So we'll start with the final line. Swarga, moksha, adi means etc., vibramaha. Swarga, heaven, moksha, liberation, etc., are called here vibrama, vibramaha, plural. They're called delusions. They're not called real. Our author here says swarga is not real. The author says moksha is not real. Moksha is not. Now, swarga is not real. You can probably, you won't have a problem with that, perhaps. But moksha is not real. How can you say that? This is actually one of the very beautiful and profound teachings that we find in the Mandukya Karika of Gaudapada and other advanced texts, which point to the fact that bondage is due to ignorance. If ignorance is the cause, bondage is the effect. If ignorance is not absolutely real, the effect of ignorance, bondage, cannot be absolutely real. You follow the logic. There's a lot of logic in this text, being an advanced text. Bondage is a result of ignorance. Ignorance, which is mithya, causes bondage, which is mithya. The problem of being bound is not absolutely real. In fact, if bondage were absolutely real, remember our definition of real? That which doesn't change, doesn't come and go. So if bondage were absolutely real, there's no way to come to an end of bondage. But like anything else in the world, bondage is not absolutely real. It's empirically real. It comes to an end. But here's the point now. If bondage is not absolutely real, how can moksha be real? Moksha is the opposite of bondage, the absence of bondage. So if bondage is not absolutely real, if bondage is part of this empirical life, then moksha too is not absolutely real, it's empirically real. That's the logic. To give it in a more pure Vedanta way, consider this. Bondage and moksha don't belong to consciousness. Excuse me. Consciousness, we said, is unchanging. That which is unchanging can't go through different states. Unchanging consciousness can't first be in a state of bondage and later in a state of moksha. Just like consciousness doesn't have, we had this discussion recently when we talked about the three states, the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state. We had a long discussion in which we established that these three states are not three states of consciousness. Remember that discussion? There are three states of your mind. Consciousness is unchanging. Unchanging consciousness reveals what's happening in your mind when you're awake. Unchanging consciousness reveals what's happening in your mind when you're dreaming. Unchanging consciousness reveals the absence of activity in your mind in dreamless sleep. The point is that it's your mind that undergoes three states. It changes from one state to another. Consciousness doesn't undergo these three states. Consciousness undergoes no change whatsoever. Then how can consciousness have a state of bondage and a state of liberation? You see that. Unchanging consciousness never got stuck in a state of bondage. Unchanging consciousness doesn't get freed from bondage and gain moksha. So just as waking, dream, and sleep belong to your mind, belong to you, the individual being, the jiva, the jiva who is stuck in ignorance and stuck in worldly life, in the same way, bondage and moksha belong to that jiva, to that limited individual. Or to put it another way, bondage and moksha belong to the mind, really speaking. Bondage is due to the presence of ignorance in the mind. Excuse me. the ignorance, which, as I said before, leads to identification with the body and mind, and that identification leads to suffering, and bondage means suffering. Bondage to what? Bondage to be stuck in a life of suffering. So that bondage is due to ignorance in the mind. When the ignorance in your mind is removed, what happens to consciousness? You get it. Nothing happens to consciousness. Your mind is freed from ignorance. Your mind is freed from bondage. Your mind is freed from suffering. Freedom from suffering is moksha. But all of that occurs in the mind. I think I quoted in, I think, last week's class, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha moksha yoho. Mana eva, the mind alone, is the karanam, the cause, manushyanam, for all people. It's the cause for bandha moksha yoho, for bondage and moksha. Comes from this quote, Amrita Bindu Upanishad. You can look it up. So, with that in mind, we say that the problem of bondage and moksha is at the empirical level. Like the problem of dream thirst is at a dream level, at the pratibhasika level. Here, the problem of bondage is at the empirical level, vyavaharika satta, and therefore moksha similarly is at that empirical level. For this reason, swarga mokshari vibhramaha, from the absolute standpoint, from the standpoint of an enlightened person, from the standpoint of one established in paramarthika satta, absolute reality, from the standpoint of absolute reality, swarga is vibhrama. It's an error. It's an illusion or delusion, just like dream thirst. Similarly, moksha, exactly the same. Swarga and moksha belong to this empirical reality. From the standpoint of absolute reality, they have no existence whatsoever. Just like from the standpoint of clay, there's no pot at all. We've had this discussion. From the standpoint of clay, there is no pot. From the standpoint of absolute reality, paramarthika satta, there is no swarga, heaven, and there is no moksha, liberation. Swarga, mokshadi vibhramaha, these delusions of heaven and hell and liberation and bondage, all of these, and backing up, now we're going to take it in reverse order. End of the third line, ete, all of these, you see the spuranti, ete, we have to separate those words. Spuranti, ete, ete, all of these delusions, like heaven and hell, like liberation and bondage, ete, all of these, spuranti, they appear. They appear, spuranti, they appear. How long, or where do they appear? Dirgha swapne. What a lovely expression. Dirgha swapne, in this long dream. Now, we're not talking about the dream. The dream you have at night is not that long. In fact, most, I think, when they connect the electrodes to your head, they find out that those dreams usually last like 5 minutes. They don't last really long. They may feel really long, but in fact, they're not really long. So here, dirgha swapna, long dream, is not referring to what you experience at night. The long dream is what's happening right now. Right now, empirical reality is a dirgha swapna. It is a long dream. When did this long dream begin? Well, in modern science, this long dream began 13.7 billion years ago. That's a long dream. But the point is, dreams come to an end. As long as this dream existed, 13.7 billion years, it has an end. When is the end? When you wake up out of the dream of ignorance, when you recognize that vyavaharika satta, this empirical world that we experience, is not absolutely real. So all of these delusions, like heaven and hell, like bondage and liberation, they all appear in this long dream of empirical experience. And where is that? Backing up. Asmin jagat maye. They appear asmin in this what? Jagat maye, that which is in the form of jagat, the world, jagat maya, that which is in the form of the world. So this, again, heaven and hell, liberation and bondage, they all appear in this long dream of empirical existence, which is this world in which we live, this world that has existed for 13.7 billion years, this world which is, now the first line and the first half of the second is one long compound word, Atma Ajnana Maha Nidra Drimbite, describing this world which is drimbita, projected, imagined, created, this world which is created by what? By Maha Nidra. Nidra you may know as sleep. This is Maha Nidra, the great sleep. Why is it called great sleep? This is an interesting... I skipped over this before. We'll talk about it now. So, not just nidra, sleep. Obviously, you get it that sleep here is a metaphor for ignorance. But why mahanidra, great sleep? When you sleep at night, there's a time when sleep begins. Sleep has a beginning and sleep has an end. What about ignorance? Does ignorance have a beginning? The logic is, I think we did this here in an earlier class. If ignorance has a beginning, it's preceded by a state in which there's no ignorance. Meaning, ignorance, if ignorance has a beginning, it's preceded by knowledge. Huh? How could ignorance begin following knowledge? Ignorance has no beginning. You were born ignorant. We're all born ignorant. And this ignorance that we're talking about in Vedanta, this ignorance you've been born with again and again and again, if you believe in reincarnation, in every prior life you were born into a state of ignorance, and this rebirth again and again has been going on for cycle after cycle of creation. From the beginning of time itself, ignorance wasn't born. Ignorance is anadi, beginningless. So that anadi ajnana, beginningless ignorance, here is called maha nidra, the great sleep. This beginningless sleep of ignorance, he says, which is ajnana, which is atma ajnana, which is ajnana, ignorance of atma, of the true self. So, to summarize the whole verse, so swarga, heaven and hell, liberation and bondage all exist in this long dream of empirical existence, empirical experience. It's all part of the world, and it is all present. It's all present from the beginning of time, if we want to take the Western point of view, 13.7 billion years. The point is that it's Mahanidra. It may be beginningless, but it has an end. This ignorance of your true nature, Satchidananda Atma, has an end when these teachings lead you to discover your true nature. And then you will come to understand that Swarga and Naraka, heaven and hell, and liberation and bondage, you'll understand that they are all empirically real. They're real like the pot, but they're not absolutely real like clay. They're apparently real, not absolutely real. Oh, one last point here. When you're enlightened, how important are the scriptures? When you're enlightened, you now consider the scriptures to be only of empirical reality. So then how do you look at the scriptures? And the answer is in a very pragmatic way. If you need a cup for some water, even if you're enlightened, you're still going to grab a cup. You're not going to get some clay. Clay won't help you drink water. A pot will help you drink water. If you're enlightened with regard to the clay pot, you still have a pragmatic relationship with the pot. Even though you know the pot is not absolutely real, you still have a pragmatic relationship. It's useful. In the same way, you have an enlightened person will not consider the scriptures to be absolutely real, but that enlightened person will have a pragmatic attitude towards the scriptures. They are useful. Okay. Yeah, we have time for one more verse. Jada jada vibhago yam, jada jada vibhago yam, ajade mai kalpitaha, ajade mai kalpitaha, bhitti bhage same chitra, bhitti bhage same chitra, chara chara vibhagavata, chara chara vibhagavata. So each of these verses are a response to a doubt or an argument. What is the doubt? The commentary will describe all this in detail. The commentator says the doubt is this. In Vedanta, we speak a lot about the duality of observer and observed, the duality of drik and drishya, seer and seen. The commentator uses a word bhoga and bhokta. Bhoga is not enjoyment, experience. Experience and bhokta, experiencer. You are the experiencer. Whatever you experience is experienced. You are the bhokta. Anything you experience, the commentator says, is bhoga, experience. I thought we were studying Advaita Vedanta. What is all this duality? You have knower and known, seer and seen, experiencer and experienced. How do we resolve this duality? And that's what this verse is about. It says that ayam, vibhagaha ayam, the last part of the first line, ayam, this vibhagaha, this division. This division between what and what? Between jada and ajada. Jada, inert. Ajada, not inert. Not inert means conscious. So in all those divisions, so between seer and seen, the seer is chetana, conscious, and that which is seen is jada, inert. In observer and observed, the observer is chetana, conscious, and the observed is jada. inert. In the commentator's language, the bhokta, the experiencer, is chetana, chit, conscious, consciousness. But that which is experienced, bhoga, is jada, inert. So all of these dualities can be represented as a duality between jada, that which is an inert object, and ajada, that which is not an inert object, that which is conscious. So that basic division is between that which is conscious and that which is inert. So this division is kalpitaha. It is projected. It is a fiction of your imagination due to ignorance. It is projected where is anything projected? Ajare mayi. Mayi, in me. In me, in my true nature, in my true conscious nature, which is ajare, which is not jada, which is consciousness. So he's saying whatever you experience is projected upon consciousness. This is how our minds work. What would your mind be in the absence of consciousness? There's no mind in the absence of consciousness. So whatever is in your mind is projected on consciousness. I don't think we want to get into this big topic to get into at the end of a class, so let me try to treat it in a simple way. Just as this pot is a projection upon clay, in the same way, whatever happens in your mind is a projection upon consciousness. Another way of looking at it is this pot is made of clay. It's a form of clay. In the same way, the thoughts in your mind are made of consciousness. I think we've used long ago, we used the metaphor of waves in the ocean. The vrittis, the thoughts in your mind, are like waves in the ocean. Every wave is a form projected upon water. Every vritti in your mind is a thought form projected upon consciousness. So here he is saying that whatever you perceive, whether you perceive something that looks sentient or something that's insentient, something that's jada, inert, or something that's ajada, sentient, all of that, both of these are projected upon consciousness, the consciousness which is your true nature. Now, just to introduce the final part of this, there's a little trick here. And that is, do you experience both inert, when you look out into the world around you, do you find things that are inert, like chair, and then things that are not inert, things that are conscious, like Swami Taratmananda? And we tend to make these two divisions between inert things like chair and non-inert jada, inert things like chair, and ajada, non-inert things like Swami Taratmananda. But there's actually something wrong with that. When you perceive a chair, you're perceiving form. When you perceive Swami Taratmananda, you're perceiving a form. You're not perceiving consciousness. We have no way, with our eyes, with our ears, with our five senses, we have no way of perceiving consciousness. We can perceive form and color and sound and touch and all the whatever our five senses can pick up. We perceive all that. We have no way of perceiving consciousness. In fact, everything you perceive with your five senses is jada, including Swami Taratmananda. We infer the presence of consciousness. Notice, we don't perceive with our five senses, we don't perceive consciousness, but we infer the presence of consciousness. The inference goes like this: since Swami Tadatmananda talks and behaves like you, you know you are a conscious person, so you infer, based on your experience, you infer Swami Tadatmananda is a conscious person. But my point is that inference is not perception. You do not directly perceive consciousness. And further, your inference might even be wrong. I think I joked before that Swami Tadatmananda could be a very well-designed robot created by an advanced civilization that's been planted here on this planet. You don't know. And my point is, inference could be wrong. What you perceive is only jada. And that's how he concludes here. He says, whatever you perceive he gives the metaphor, it is like bhitti bhage same chitra chara achara vibhagavat. The division between sentient and insentient, between jara and ajara, that you perceive in the world, he says, it is in the last line, vibhagavat, like the division, like the separation between chara and achara, chara moving things, achara unmoving things, but things which are chitra in a picture, in a painting. In a painting which is bhitti bhage, which are, bhitti is wall, bhaga, a section of a wall, same, on a flat section of wall, you can have a painting of a landscape and a painting of many people on that landscape. And the point he is making is that all the landscape that you perceive, he uses the word achara. It is like jada. It is inert, it doesn't move. But the pictures of people on that landscape painted on the flat wall, those people painted on the wall are as jada as the landscape painted on the wall, right? The landscape doesn't move, nor do the people move. It's all the same. Whatever is painted on the wall, whether it's landscape or people, it's all the same. It's all projected on the wall, painted on the wall. In the same way, whatever you perceive is all the same. There aren't two categories. What you perceive with your eyes is all jada. Just as the landscape and people painted on the wall are the same, in the same way, the chair that you perceive and the Swami Tadatmananda that you perceive are the same, because with our five senses, we can only perceive that which is jada. But all that is jada that we perceive is all projected. The painting is painted on the flat part of the wall. In the same way, everything you perceive with your five senses is projected on the consciousness which is your mind, with the consciousness by which your mind is known. It is the mind's projection, just like the pot projected on clay, just like the waves on the water, in the same way. Thoughts are forms, perceptions. This chair that you see is a projection on your own consciousness. This Swami Tadatmananda that you see is projected on your own consciousness. What's the difference? They're all projected on consciousness, meaning neither one of them are real. The landscape painted on the wall, they're not real trees, and the people painted on the wall are not real people. In the same way, the chair that you see right now is not real. The Swami Taratmananda that you perceive right now is not real. What is real is the consciousness upon which they're projected. The consciousness that reveals the presence of the chair in your mind. The consciousness that reveals the presence of Swami Taratmananda in your mind. That consciousness is the one reality. All these divisions, this duality, the duality we seem to perceive between living things and inert things is all fiction, absolute fiction. Very good. We'll conclude here. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukkha Bhag Bhavet. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityor Ma Hamritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat.